Hello, and welcome to our second episode of the Marie Keating Foundation Talks Cancer podcast with myself, Director of Nursing Services, Helen Forrestal. We're delighted to be back and share even more valuable information with you today. From this episode onwards, we let the patient voices take the lead. Today, I'm going to talk to two women from the Marie Keating Foundation Survive and Thrive community about not only surviving, but thriving after a breast cancer diagnosis. This episode covers a wide range of valuable information that stems from the lived experiences of these ladies. We discuss at diagnosis what they would like women or men to know that they did not know back then. Treatments, benefits versus risks, family history, choices, trauma, follow-up, support services, and so much more. So with all this to cover, we better get started. Well, here we are on our second episode of Breast Cancer. I'm delighted to have you here, Erica, with us today, and you too, Paula. And I think something we've talked about, which we all feel in this room is very important, is actually like calling it out, you know, calling out your breast cancer, your subtype, and whatever hormonal influence that might have for you. So, Erica, I'm going to start off with yourself. Thanks so much for being here, Erica. Will you introduce yourself?
Yeah. Hi, Helen. Thanks for having me. I'm going to start with me first and then I'll do the cancer me second. So my name is Erica Tierney. I'm 36. I'm originally from Dublin, living in Kildare. I'm a scientist by background. I work in the pharmaceutical industry now. And I was diagnosed with breast cancer when I was 33. With our first little girl. So, well, first and only little girl. So I was age 33, diagnosed 30 weeks pregnant, and the type of breast cancer I had was a stage 3 ductal carcinoma. I had a large tumour, so the main tumour was approximately 5 centimetres in diameter. I had to have a mastectomy while pregnant, and during that surgery, I found that I also had tumours in my axillary nodes under the armpit. So I had 5 tumours there too. So I had a full axillary node clearance as well as part of that surgery. Then after I had Rocha, I went on to have 6 months of chemo and radiation, and I'm 2 years into my 10 years of tamoxifen. I have done a lot of reconstruction surgeries. So I've had 3 reconstruction surgeries for the Dieppe flap reconstruction. Had my final surgery 3 weeks ago. So I'm a little bit in celebration mode that I've closed the book on that, and I'm just running down the clock on tamoxifen.
Yeah, wow. 8 more years to go on tamoxifen,
yeah,
but
yeah.
Hey, you
two
know.
Done.
Yeah, look, well, congratulations, Erica, on that. I mean, that's a phenomenal story. We know today that we're actually going to share a lot of the learnings that you've had through your cancer journey with others and help them to know what you didn't know. And yourself, Paula, how are you?
I'm good. Thanks very much also for having me. So my name is Paula Gleason and I'm 46, so 10 years older than you, Erica. So I have 3 daughters and now a dog in the last year as well. My background is I'm a nurse and I work in the children's hospital, which is lovely. So my diagnosis came for me, I suppose, a bit of a bolt out of the blue. I had been I'd been with breast check for kind of painful breast. It seemed to have settled by the time I actually had my mammogram and got a recall then to go back, and assuming that it was on, it wasn't anything major because it was a 6 weeks since I'd had the mammogram. So yeah, it was a big shock when I went in and they found the breast cancer. And like Erica, mine was quite big, so I had to have a mastectomy, but they were hopeful it wasn't very high grade, that would be sufficient. So I had a mastectomy and reconstruction in one surgery, but unfortunately it had also gone to my lymph nodes. So I had to go back then in the middle of COVID, or just beginning of COVID, have my axillary clearance. And then I had 3 months of chemotherapy and radiotherapy then after that. So I'm currently on a clinical trial, which is just looking at a particular type of medication that to see whether or not it would prevent breast cancer recurrence. So I'm on year 2 of a 3-year trial.
Okay. So thanks, Paula, for sharing that. And being a nurse, something I picked up there, and the scientists in the room, I would imagine that might have been a little bit maybe challenging or tricky, in the sense that you probably already knew quite a bit about cancer and cancer diagnosis. And you've both mentioned your subtypes. Or Paula, did you mention your subtype?
I didn't actually.
Okay, tell us what that.
I mentioned that. So mine was, I was stage 3 invasive ductal carcinoma as well.
Yeah.
But mine was estrogen, progesterone positive, but HER2 negative.
Okay. That's a mouthful, isn't it?
It is.
So there's a bit of learning there, I suppose, for our listeners, isn't it? It might be important to think about your breast cancer in a little bit more detail, if that's what you wish for, in order to understand it better and in order to, I suppose, inform yourself of the best optimal treatment for that type of breast cancer. Okay, so Eric, I'm going to come back to you. We talked earlier and you mentioned oncology rehab as something that you weren't, that you kind of needed to know more about at the time. Will you tell me a little bit about that?
Yeah, sure. So that's something that I'm passionate about as well. When I was diagnosed, I mean, the finish line is never really in sight. Well, it wasn't for me anyway. I was a real day by day person.
Yeah.
And I think that might have been from coinciding having my first baby and dealing with cancer too. So I was very much, what do I need to do tomorrow? And then I wouldn't think about anything in the future, because also I didn't really know until I think, so I was diagnosed in the September, I had Roche in November, and I didn't find out until the Christmas when they could continue finishing the scans that I needed that I was in stage 4. So I had to live in this limbo space.
Okay. Yeah.
So I had to take it day by day. And then, so when I came to the end of my treatment, I faced this massive wall because I was absolutely exhausted. Yet all my medical appointments were done. I was only going to be routinely checked every few months for a mammogram, and then every other few months meeting the breast surgeon. And at that point, I was struggling to walk to the shop. I was incredibly fatigued.
Mm-hmm.
Every time my daughter was napping, I was napping. Like, I always felt like I was running down the clock waiting for nap time. And I wish that I had have known at the time the importance of rehab and getting myself that first appointment almost the day I finished treatment to get a plan in place.
And Erica, can I just ask you there, who would you have expected to give you that information?
I would have taken it from anyone, but I guess maybe, I don't know, one of the nurses on the chemo team or on the radiation team.
Yeah.
And I don't know if COVID had a lot to do with it for my part as well, but my tamoxifen script was just left at reception and off I went on my merry way.
Yeah.
And I was lucky, you know, I just started digging myself online. And I was actually going to her to find out about lymphedema.
Mm.
And it was that chartered physio who specialised in both onco rehab and lymphedema that gave me a 4-month plan. And she took me from being able to walk for 5 minutes to 10 kilometres in 4 months. And I don't know what I would have done otherwise, because I really felt like Humpty Dumpty. I was like, I don't know what to do here.
And of course, like, you know, you didn't just have breast cancer. You'd also had a new baby.
Yeah.
You know, and consider all of those changes in your body and that whole kind of rehabilitation and energy levels and everything that goes with that.
Absolutely.
So can you just explain, though, for listeners, like oncology rehab? It meant maybe having a physiotherapist.
Mm-hmm.
To help you and guide you through that kind of fatigue and mobility. Were there any other professionals involved?
So for me, it was that chartered physiotherapist.
Yeah.
I believe now, so I would have been diagnosed in 2019.
Mm.
And now I think there are some programs in the public and private space where you'll be informed of this program. Helen, you might know the name of the program itself.
Yeah, I think it's Xwell, isn't it?
Xwell.
Yeah.
Okay, yeah. So I know those kind of programs exist.
Yeah.
So, you know, I just can't underline how important that is. I kind of feel like I might still be stuck to a couch if I haven't found it, if I didn't find out about it.
Yeah.
Hugely important.
Really important, and I suppose just while we're on the subject of oncology rehab, there's a very important aspect of kind of managing you holistically as well, mind, body, but also somebody looking, you know, being overall, not necessarily in charge, but looking out for your best interest, which would probably be a medical social worker. Did you get an immediate referral to a medical social worker? Or
I got a referral to a social worker when I started asking questions about my maternity leave.
Okay.
So for an entirely different reason. So I didn't actually have a lot of dealings with the social worker. Maybe you did, Paula?
No, I was never referred to a medical social worker. And I really think it would have been beneficial to be referred to somebody in the beginning. I think when you're diagnosed initially, it's all about the treatment and the surgery. And it would be lovely to meet with somebody who thinks of the things outside of that,
yeah.
of the practical side, maybe the financial side, and helps you to navigate that part of it.
Absolutely, mm-hmm. yeah. So it's interesting, isn't it, again, and maybe for our listeners, if you're somebody who's diagnosed with any kind of cancer or kind of any you know, chronic illness that might affect your ability and your well-being, that a medical social worker is somebody that maybe we should be, well, look, the responsibility shouldn't be on you as a patient at the time either, but that referral, you know, process happens kind of with immediacy.
Yeah. And I think that's where the charities like yourselves and others really come in, you know, having those helplines and guiding you towards that. I think the financial implication of having cancer is huge as well, which is something
Absolutely.
That snowballs the more you go into the journey.
Yeah.
And so knowing at the outset that how complex that can be to manage, I think it's something to think about in the early days too, when you don't feel as weak as you do at the end.
Yeah, and definitely if a medical social worker isn't available, that everyone should be kind of nearly advised or recommended to talk to somebody, you know, to get those supports. And it reduces the anxiety if there's things that you can manage outside of, you know, take that financial pressure away or whatever it might be for you that you need.
Yeah, absolutely. So a more holistic approach to care really, isn't it?
And definitely.
I mean, I know there's so much to talk about here, but Erica, I know you have been very proactive, you know, because of the circumstances you found yourself in and the real challenges and difficulties being pregnant, having a baby and actually been diagnosed with cancer. That must have been horrendous for you.
Yeah, it was a little bit like getting hit by a truck.
Yeah.
You know, we were gearing up for having our baby, painting her room. We didn't know it was a her at the time. But in that really, really happy space when you're having your first baby. And when I found the lump, I really just thought it was a change in my breast tissue because I was pregnant.
Yeah.
Thankfully, I have a sister who is a midwife and she said, I think it's nothing but just go to the GP. And within 2 weeks, I had the full diagnosis, pathology, and there was instantaneous talk of a mastectomy. I didn't even know you could get a general while you were pregnant unless it was a really a case of a trauma or something like that. So I was just so surprised, just really concerned for my baby at that point, and making sure that she was going to be okay, and then having a really, really short recovery and straight into chemotherapy. You know, I was so jealous of all the other moms just in coffee shops and going to, well, I did go to water babies, but I sat on the bench while my husband did water babies with her. Mm-hmm. Just all those little things like that are hugely important to you to just lose those.
So you felt like you'd lost out quite a lot.
Yeah.
Of course.
I really, really did. Yeah. And, you know, you never get that time back.
Yeah.
And I used to... Everything was for Rocha. So if I had energy, I was doing something with Rocha. I let the house fall down around me. And I think that's really important advice for other women facing into it. So what if the kitchen is clean? Yeah. You know, do what's important to you. Spend time with your kids. Go on adventures. They're not going to remember how tidy or dirty the house was while Mom was sick. So,
That must have been huge learning for you, Erica, along the way. And I know... And I would, again, congratulate here for what you have done for, you know, people in Ireland who find themselves in the very circumstance that you found yourselves in. You're a strong advocate for a reform and change, aren't you, for women who are diagnosed with cancer during pregnancy.
And I suppose people say in advocacy, you never decide you're going to become an advocate. It's not something that's on the CAO.
Mm.
And I think it's just a life circumstance where you just can't abide by something that's happening that forces you to make that change. So what I decided maybe when I was a month finished chemo and radiation that I was going to do something about it. I was unfortunate enough in that the entire period of my maternity leave overlapped with my active treatment window. And so I remember sitting on the at the kitchen counter, and my husband had brought the post in. He said, "Oh, there's post for you." And it was a letter from the Department of Social Welfare saying that my maternity leave was up next week. And that was just a week after I finished treatment. Oh. And I just felt like that was such a kick in the face. You know, yeah. there was no real understanding of what I'd been through. And so I went to the charities, I went to yourselves, I went to the Irish Cancer Society, and I said, look, is there a knowledge out there that this is happening? I know there's not many women like me, but there's still 60 of us a year.
Yeah.
We need to make change here. It's just, you know, because I think there's always this expectation in our heads about how quickly we need to get back to work and get back to normal. And so to get that when you're that sick, it kind of begs the question, does society think I'm supposed to go back to work now? Like, because there's such a miss there.
Mm-hmm.
So we've been busy for, I think, maybe the last year and a half, really busy, campaigning, building up knowledge. We announced at the Dáil about the campaign. We've had a lot of interactions with politicians. I don't think any politician in Ireland could say we're not going to reform this.
Mm-hmm.
And it will be huge brownie points for anyone who does come on board with us and make it happen.
Yeah.
So we're really hoping that this won't take very long to fix. But the impact of it in fixing that maternity leave and allowing us to postpone it or delay it for anyone who's walked my path, it would just be such a huge comfort and not a huge financial implication for the government.
Yeah. And I really hope that this happens for you, Erica, and very, very, very proud of what you've done.
Thank you. And thanks for all the support as well.
Not at all. I mean, we've walked that line with you, I think, in the whole survivorship space. And this is what it's about, isn't it? It's about like allowing you and everybody else who's listening today who might find themselves in that situation to actually live, you know, mm-hmm. to survive, but to thrive in this space and live your best life. And for you and for your children and for your child, you know, for your child.
And a huge aspect of it as well is taking control. Like, I don't know about you, Paula, but maybe I'm a control freak, but I always felt like I just had to let all of the decisions rest on other people's shoulders. And I was robbed of that, you know, along the way.
Yeah,
the medics help you to make your choices for the most part. So being able to take back a little bit of control and say, I'm going to do this, I'm going to achieve this, I think is really positive. And whatever that is for you as you come out of your cancer journey, it could be something small, but just to take control of something that's really important.
Yeah. Did you feel the same, Paula?
Yeah, definitely. You see things that are absent that you'd like to improve for those who come after you.
Yeah. And sure, this is what this is all about, isn't it?
Mm.
We learn things in our lives, don't we? And it's like the lived experience. And if something is very unpleasant and unforgiving almost, isn't it, Erica, that you have to do something, you feel you have to do something about that.
Yeah.
Yeah. So definitely very proud, you know, of what you're achieving.
We will be celebrating someday soon.
We will indeed, yeah. Yeah. Paula, we've talked as well, and you have a strong family history in your family, don't you?
I do. I'm from a big family. I have 10 siblings, and I've had a number of family members who've also had breast cancer. So, I would have kind of a lot of interest in kind of about the whole family history part.
Yeah.
And do think the importance of screening for family members is vital, you know.
What have you learned about yourself along the way, just in terms of having a big family and having knowledge maybe?
I suppose knowledge can be good and bad. I suppose as a nurse, as you said before, you can know a lot and sometimes you can know too much.
Yeah.
And I guess certainly in the beginning, I would have worried a lot about different things because, I suppose having that knowledge, but also I suppose knowledge took a lot of the fear for me around treatment. Treatment was hard, but I knew, you know, there's an end goal in sight. My prognosis was good, you know. So, I do definitely think it reduced that fear around the treatment that I knew, right, I'm going to feel awful, but it's for a finite length of time. And ultimately, you know, it'll...
You had confidence in...
Absolutely,
Good. Yeah. And just going back to the family history, what did you learn in that process? Like, did other members of your family go for sort of genetic testing?
I guess... Those of us who hadn't had a diagnosis, it got them all going for a regular screening so that, you know, God forbid anyone should develop it, that it can be picked up early because obviously early diagnosis is key. And I suppose for women out there to know, like, to a large degree, if it's picked up early, you get early treatment. People live with it and go on to live long and healthy lives.
Yeah.
From a screening point of view, there, I suppose it's quite limited, the facilities out there. For me, I had to wait a year for genetic testing. And I suppose it's important for people. Not, I guess, I suppose with having a family who have had, a strong family history, not everyone wants to have the genetic testing. And and I suppose ultimately it can be useful for some of the big gene mutations like BRCA.
Yeah.
But it doesn't reduce your risk always either. For me, I didn't have any genetic mutation. Mm-hmm. But it doesn't change things, I suppose, for me going forward. It still will need to be screened and monitored. But
but knowledge is power, as you say.
Absolutely.
Isn't it? In this particular space. And like, I suppose as Marie Keating Foundation nurses, we're in the community a lot. And one of the things we would say to people that we meet, even opportunistically, would be to say, it's really important to know your family history.
Absolutely.
In terms of risk. And just that knowledge itself, or the realization that there is something happening in your family or not, as the case may be.
And also, I suppose, just to mention a little bit around breast density, because that was something that I found out after, that I did have dense breast tissue. And I would wonder if I had other screening previous to, like, I had a mammogram before, but maybe if I'd had an ultrasound before, maybe mine would have been picked up earlier. Who's to know? But I suppose to have that knowledge around breast density, to have that knowledge to know, well, maybe actually, could I have a breast ultrasound, or could I have an MRI or something like that that might have, you know.
So, Paulie, you've just mentioned breast density there. Will you explain that a little bit for the listeners?
I suppose what it means is you have dense breast tissue. Mm. And I suppose not when you have dense breast tissue, cancer doesn't always show up on a mammogram.
Okay.
And you may need different kind of tests, such as an ultrasound or an MRI.
So it's just being mindful of that when you're having tests done.
Exactly.
And to ask the question.
Maybe. Exactly. And in fact, when I was diagnosed on a mammogram, mine looked tiny. But actually, when they did an ultrasound, it was in three different areas and it spread over nearly 10 centimetres in different directions. And, you know, so...
Yeah.
You'd wonder how long it was there.
Yeah. So early detection, knowing signs and symptoms, knowing what your body looks like. Yeah.
And
what's
not
normal
for you? And not being afraid to kind of push.
Yeah.
I think that's really important retrospectively as well, as breast cancer survivors, that, you know, we might have changes in the future too, and you know best. So even if after a diagnosis, when you're in your survivorship, if something doesn't feel right, do something about it as soon as possible.
We're actually in another episode going to talk to women with metastatic breast cancer, or maybe for listeners, I might say advanced breast cancer as well. They've talked about that whole understanding of the multidisciplinary team process and, you know, the reassurances that it gives somebody if they know about it. But if they don't know about it, they're often thinking about seeking second opinions there's nothing wrong with a second opinion. And in fact, as healthcare professionals, it would be very much encouraged if you're feeling uncomfortable or a little bit uninformed, or actually just want a second opinion to see what somebody else, another expert, might have to say.
It definitely does give you that confidence to know that a group of experts have sat down together and made and, you know, discussed you and made treatment decisions, you know, between them. It's not just one person out there who's deciding what treatment you have. It's a whole load of professionals and experts. Yeah.
Clinical trials. Just want to ask you one question about that.
Yeah.
Were you aware of the clinical trials, or is it something that you researched yourself and brought it to the fore, or was it something that was kind of information that was given to you?
So for me, it was information that was given to me. Okay. When I finished my treatment and I went back to my oncologist, one of the research nurses came to me and she just suggested that maybe it was something I'd be interested in. I met the criteria for a trial called the Natalie trial that they're running currently. And I suppose with the family history and I suppose the fact that I was stage 3, it was definitely something that I was interested in. What the trial I'm involved in is looking at a particular group of medications called CDK4 and 6 inhibitors. Mm. And what they're looking to see is whether or not these may, by going on a course of the medication, it might reduce the risk of recurrence.
Okay. So really important, isn't it?
It is. And I suppose it's exciting to be involved in something that, you know, that going forward might have huge benefits for other women, yeah, as well as for myself.
Yeah. And that word that you've brought up there, recurrence, okay, that's a scary word, I think, isn't it?
It is. And yeah, it's something, I suppose, that is a little bit at the back of your head. Yeah. Obviously, you go on with your life and you're living your full life. But, you know, there is that possibility there. Mm. And, you know, when something we're conscious of. And I guess another element of the clinical trial, which gives a lot of reassurance, is the appointments and the screening that comes with it. Because, you know, as Erica was saying, you finish your treatment, yeah, you have your appointment, and suddenly you're on your own to a degree. And I guess being involved in the clinical trial, there is that little bit of extra reassurance you get.
Yeah, and that's fantastic to know. And as just going back to that point that you were, you know, that finishing treatment, the completion of treatment, but you're still a different person, aren't you?
Oh, 100%. Yeah.
Been, you know, going back to normal is I suppose a new normal, isn't it? Or whatever, you know, however you want to classify it, because cancer is a life-changing event. It changes the way you think and feel about everything, doesn't it?
Mm-hmm. I remember the day I was diagnosed, I said, this isn't going to affect me psychologically. I made myself a promise.
Yeah.
And I said, I'm just going to deal with this. I had a bye-bye booby, hello baby party. I was like trying to be so positive about it. But now I've come to realise that it has changed me, and that's okay. And maybe a lot of it does make you stronger than you ever were before, and a hell of a lot more resilient.
Yeah.
So you will find that you change along your journey. But yeah, you kind of have to embrace it, I think.
Yeah, definitely.
Okay, that's probably a nice way to finish this episode. But I'm coming back to both you, Erica, and Paula for our final episode on survivorship, because you both have something in common here, and you both participated in the Marie Keating Foundation Survive and Thrive program, and it's very much a self-management program. I hope that helps you to kind of, you know, move into a space of survivorship, but not only surviving your cancer. And you're both proving it. You're thriving, you know, after your cancer diagnosis as well. So my final question probably to you, Erica, would be that major take-home message for our listeners today from you.
My major take-home message would be to get yourself into a rehab program. If I could think of, you know, the single most important thing in your recovery is to empower yourself to make those changes and to get strong again, and whatever that looks like for you.
Okay. And for you, Paula?
For me, it would be, though there are a lot of similarities between women and men with breast cancer and their treatments, everyone's journey is different.
Yeah.
Don't compare yourself with anybody else. And your recovery takes as long as your recovery takes. So be kind to yourself. You know, just take your time. Look at what's right for you. And get the, you know, look at the different supports that are out there to help on your recovery journey. But I definitely would say, yeah, you are yourself and everyone is different.
Yeah. Take time and a bit of self-compassion along
Absolutely.
The way.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Okay. I think we'll sign off on that note, will we? Great. Thanks, Erica. Thanks, Paula.
Thanks very much, Helen.
Thank you.
That's all for this episode. Thank you again to our wonderful guests for their inspirational insights and learnings. To our sponsors, Novartis and Roche, for their support in making this series possible. And to you for tuning in. Join us next time, where we will once again be talking all about breast cancer. And in the meantime, you can visit mariekeating.ie for more information on breast cancer awareness and support.